Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're looking at how you can maintain your privacy in the face of surveillance advertising and some other internet technologies. And back with us today, Jesse LeGrew. Jesse, an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. And we'll talk with Jesse about facial recognition, how to help young people stay safe on the internet. And of course, we'll take your other tech-related questions as well as we move along. Hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, we just heard the news on Twitter with the whistleblower speaking to members of Congress, and we'll probably get to that as we move along. But I want to talk about surveillance advertising just to start out. Maybe just define it, what it is and what it means.
Yeah, and really for, in this case, surveillance, it's really the ability to track individuals or devices pretty much wherever you go or with whatever you do. So being able to know a little bit more about an individual's behavior based on, you know, the websites that they're going to and using a variety of different technologies to do that. So really keeping an eye on what you're doing and being able to really comprehensively report on that and use that data for other means. Maybe it's advertising, maybe it's sales, maybe it's both. Could be something else completely, but really just having more data than you probably would want somebody to have.
Yeah, I can it happens a lot to me. I was looking at a gift online for a friend, something that I would never use myself. And after I did a little searching, then suddenly I'm still getting a year later all these pop-ups and suggestions on that same item or one like it. And it's kind of frustrating. It's nothing that I would normally. It makes you think a bit about where you're browsing.
Yep. Yeah. Basically, just about any website you go to. There's usually some mechanism to track that you're going there, that you're going to different sites. And then a lot of that data is also getting shared with a variety of third parties, probably the websites you just went to, but also maybe websites you haven't been to before. And that data might also be sold to a variety of third parties. So there's a lot of these kind of data aggregators that kind of exist on a lot of different websites. And, you know, one of the things that people are usually afraid of is cookies. And so a cookie on a web browser can be used to really make your web browsing experience easier. So it can remember who you are when you go to a website. And generally, when you go to that website, the only place that should be able to read that cookie is that website itself. The only other thing is you might have multiple cookies being delivered to you for any one website that you go to. And some of those might be advertising cookies, other analytics cookies that also get shared. So it's not really just that one website that's giving you that information. It's a variety of these other organizations. And that's where some of that data sharing can take place. And that's how it can be tracked when you go from one website to another. And, you know, you get this, you know, kind of comprehensive dossier of, you know, what you're doing online that, you know, people use for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. What are some of those reasons? I mean, for one, of course, is product, but.
Yeah. Targeted advertising is definitely one aspect of it, you know, which is something that you witnessed. You go to one thing, you're kind of interested maybe for one reason, you end up going to a different website and they're selling you or at least trying to show you items that are similar because, you know, you had an interest in it at one point. The other use behind it is, you know, monetary. So people are using it to target advertisements or other sales. Your information might be sold to other organizations, which might also be used for advertising or anything else. So It can be relatively easy to purchase this information. And then it's really up to that organization purchasing the information to decide, you know, what am I going to do with this? Am I going to use it for advertising or, you know, let's say a bad actor got or purchased some of this information. Maybe it could be used for a nefarious purpose, some bad purpose where maybe it's using to send out phishing emails or something else. So it kind of runs the gamut. Usually for those legitimate purposes, I guess, you know, more legitimate than like dangerous phishing emails, it's usually targeted marketing and a variety of those things that are, you know, hitting your email inbox and your web browser just about every day.
Yeah. Is that browser fingerprinting or is there that's a term I've heard.
Yeah. And so every time you visit a website, depending on the settings you have for your web browser, that website is able to collect some information. Maybe it's not able to connect or collect who you are, but it can collect other aspects about your device and about your internet connection. So, you know, if I'm at home, if I'm using my normal internet, consumer internet, I go to a website, they can say, oh, I see that you're using an iOS device of this version. So you're using maybe an iPad. You're using this version of Chrome, and I see that you're using this internet connection. And from that information, you can kind of develop a fingerprint stating, you know, this is what potentially one individual looks like. And if you do see other communications with that similar information, maybe coming from that same IP address or from that same internet provider, you might be able to use that to also track an individual going from place to place. And so that might also get sold to other third parties. So it's, you know, a lot of people have the same devices. They might have the same browser version. So it's not always completely accurate. But when you get a lot of this information and you have a lot of data tools behind it, you can actually use that for identifying individuals that use multiple devices. So, you know, I'm at home. Maybe I have two or three devices. Maybe there's three or four other people that also have two or three devices. We probably all have our unique browsing habits. And if you're able to collect all this information, you might be able to determine, well, these two devices are probably Jesse's because he's going to these specific websites. These other people aren't. And so now you have that kind of fingerprint that you might be able to look at and compare with others. So, and those are the, they uniquely identify devices to an extent. But it doesn't even go to the length that you could go to, which is identifying maybe a phone number that's identified with a particular mobile device. If you're able to get that kind of information and, you know, it's a number you've had for quite some time, that's a very good unique identifier for an individual. Most people, you know, have one phone number. They don't have multiple. They're not trying to get off the grid or trying to be completely anonymized on the internet, which can be extremely challenging. So, you know, for the standard end user, that information, you know, can be used to track pretty much all of your activity.
You mentioned phones. So can companies track cookies and take browser fingerprints from the apps that we have on our phone?
Yes. Yep. So that is, it's actually the same kind of information. What they call that information is called a user agent string. And it identifies basically the software that you're using, the version of that software, and what, you know, device you might be using. So that happens on mobile devices through apps, as well as through browsers on a laptop or a desktop. So they'll generally know whether you're using a mobile device, and they'll also know what app you're using. The downside too is those apps are also collecting their own information, which also might be resold. So there's so many different points at which this data can be collected and then either, you know, resold or given to other parties to, you know, collect and do their magic with data analytics.
It seems to me that it would be very hard to avoid being tracked by this surveillance advertising.
It's extremely difficult. And there's a variety of reasons for it. I think we've seen a lot of privacy legislation come out that helped to give end users, you know, more authority over their own data. And to be able to say, you know, I don't want to be part of this. My data is private. Do not collect it, or if you do collect it, do not sell it. Definitely for the US, you know, we have a lack of federal legislation in that regard. State by state, location by location might be stronger, but that's a challenge. So you people might have heard of like GDPR when they talk about, you know, being in a European state and having a little bit more control of that privacy data. The US isn't quite there, but, you know, there's progress being made. And that's only on the legislation side. We're not even talking about the technology. But a lot of the things we have from a technology perspective that say, hey, by the way, I'm going to browse to your website. I have this little setting on my browser that says, I want my data private. Don't collect my information. Without the legislation saying, you actually have to respect the fact that they said that, they can completely ignore it. So that's the other challenge. Some of it's a technology piece where maybe those pieces aren't in place for us yet. Or if they are, the other end of that conversation when I'm going to a website may not have the need to actually respect those wishes and the other information that they're receiving. And so that's another tricky piece. Not to mention just, you know, all the other data that we're giving people, because you can find other ways to track people based on their IP address, the devices that they're using, kind of those items we're talking about. But there's so many other barriers just because we don't have either some of the technology components in place for, you know, whatever we're using, or that legislation to help keep companies accountable to kind of the needs and the desires of the customer.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest today, as we talk, we started talking about surveillance advertising and personal privacy. We haven't gotten much into the personal privacy yet, but we will. You can join in with questions in that area or other tech questions too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa, our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today with Jesse LeGrue, information security architect and Madison College's Technology Services Group. Great to have you listening in, and questions, I hope you'll join in. And the number's 800-642-1234. Our lines, I think, are about filled, but you can also email us to ideas@wpr.org. And before we go to Linda in Brookfield, I just did want to mention facial recognition. I thought that was the coolest thing. You know, I have facial recognition on some, you know, like my credit card. I can, you know, use it for getting online to see how much money I owe the credit card company, for example. But then I've read some pieces that say that, well, it isn't all fun and roses for it, because there could be some problems with facial recognition.
Yeah, and there are a couple issues with it. I mean, one, outside of a fingerprint and maybe a password, your face is relatively public in many cases. You're walking around, everyone is actually seeing the information. So it's kind of a less private form of kind of proving who you are, just because people have that information usually publicly. You just need to walk down the street and have that information. And also, you know, a variety of organizations are collecting this data in many different ways. So you walk down a street, how many organizations have cameras up that are recording all the faces? What are they doing with that data? So, you know, there could be, it's not a privacy aspect we really thought of, you know, maybe 20 years ago. I think people like to look at pictures of others. They might have been willing to share a lot of that information, but how it can be used as kind of proving who you are can be challenging, just because that information is just, it's just less guarded unless you're sitting in a room, never posting pictures and never being around any other individual. And that's not to mention, you know, potential issues regarding bias. If there are issues being able to identify whether, you know, a face is a face or not. And so that's been, you know, an issue with a variety of products that have come up. This is, you know, been an evolving conversation. But as individuals, we tend to either do selective testing and maybe not test the population that we really need to make sure products work as intended. That might be introducing bias in a variety of ways, which makes products less usable by individuals that may not have been a part of those populations when either developing or testing that technology. So, you know, we want to make technology sure that technology works for everyone as much as we can. And, you know, if I'm trying to prove that I'm Larry, hopefully I can't take a picture easily and use it to kind of prove that I'm somebody else. But yeah, I use a variety of tools. You know, they have iris scanning that you can use, the variety of tools to help unlock. That's a little bit more secure, just because that's not as publicly available unless you're, well, taking high definition photographs, which is actually becoming easier and easier, even with the latest iPhone and the large amount of megapixel camera that you're getting on that. Even that could be a little bit challenging because you might actually be able to collect data that 5 or 10 years ago sounded like, no, that won't happen. But technology progresses, and something that might have been hard for an end user to do is becoming easier and easier every day. And so that's, you know, a constant thing to think about when we're developing technology and how we're using it.
Let's go to Linda in Brookfield. Linda, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Yes, I have a question with something that's really annoying me with a new HP desktop computer that I recently purchased. I will load the websites that I continually use, and when I come back to them, and I try and click on them, and I have to keep reloading or hitting the clock arrow, and sometimes I have to do that 2 or 3 times to get the web page to open, or sometimes I have to just open a new browser and try again. And it's very annoying. I've never had that occur with any of the other desktop computers I have. And I don't know if it's a setting issue, if there's something with the cookies, or if there's something I can disable in the settings that would stop that from happening.
Hmm. What do you think, Jesse?
There are probably a couple things I would do. One, I always like to test, is it the browser, is it the computer, or is it the internet connection? So it could be a variety of things causing the issue. If you're using a different device on that same network, if you're getting, you know, perfectly fine web pages loading, you're not having that issue, hopefully in that case, you've kind of ruled out the internet connection. So I'd recommend always testing with another device if you haven't already. Otherwise, I'd recommend trying a different browser just to see if you get different behavior. And so there's a variety of browsers that are out there. You're generally going to get Edge that comes with Windows. Since you're using an HP, I'm guessing it's going to be running Microsoft Windows. If you're having an issue with Edge, try a different browser, see if you get different behavior. If you get the same behavior, that would make me think maybe it's a network connection issue, or it might be an issue with the computer itself. I'm actually hoping it's the browser, and that if you use a different browser, you're going to get a little bit of different activity. And if you do find out it is the browser, I'd actually go in and reset your browser settings. So go into the settings for your browser, you know, delete existing cookies or information, and then try to do that over again. Every now and again, depending on the manufacturer, they might build in certain browser settings, and resetting it to the factory defaults that might come with a brand new Windows operating system might assist with making that web experience a little bit more responsive. So try a different browser, try a different device. If a different browser works, you could always just keep on doing that. Otherwise, reset your browser settings. And I'm really hoping that's going to solve the issue for you. Otherwise, it might be a little bit tricky to determine where that issue might be. If it's always happening on that one computer, it does make me think maybe there's something running on Windows that could be doing it. Granted, I do like security software, but sometimes security software can also cause unforeseen issues. And there could be either a privacy application or something else on your computer that's trying to limit some of that communication. And maybe that's causing that pause in browser activity as well. But hopefully using a different browser is going to help you narrow that down a little bit. But that's the other thing I'd consider. Is there some security software that might be causing that slowdown? Usually I don't see that with the built-in Windows Defender product, but it's a possibility to just take a look. You can always turn it off, try to access the web page again. If it's faster, well, then you at least have an idea of what it might be.
Good luck, Linda. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Catherine in Madison, we go to you now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Larry. Good to talk to you, and thanks so much for taking my question.
Sure.
So I'm an artist, and I was looking into QR codes, which are popping up everywhere, and I was looking into using a free site to generate a QR code that would take people to my website or Instagram. And someone had mentioned that there can be some safety issues in terms of security, that some of the sites might do something to sort of redirect or put ads in. And I didn't know if this is true, and if it is, like, how can you, because I'm looking at using like a free site. I don't do it very often. I don't have a big budget or anything. Is that something to be worried about? And I know, is it static versus dynamic? Like, one you can reset the link that it goes to, that's dynamic, and I don't know what the other one's called. Is there a difference between the safety of those two? If there are certain, like, how can you tell if one of those free sites is actually safe? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. And there are a lot of QR creation softwares out there, either online or through apps.
Somebody's already asked, what's a QR code?
Yep, and a QR code is what it is when you do take a look. It's those kind of strange little pictures you've seen. They're little squares that kind of look like they have black dots all over the place. Mm-hmm. Every now and again, you might, you know, walk down and you'll see an advertisement with this little thing. Might not even know what it is, but what you can do is you can take a cell phone with your camera and you can basically hover over that image, and the device can read that and turn it into a web address or turn it into information that otherwise is difficult. When we try to give somebody a website to go to, Google.com is relatively easy to remember. Maybe you have a specific search result that you're interested in sharing with other people. Well, Google.com search /, you know, you have this large piece of data that's hard to remember. It's going to be hard to type in. QR codes are used to help with that, really, to make that experience going to it easier and to make sure no one has to type in a really long URL. Because it's easy to make mistakes and to really go to the wrong place. So part of it's easier than just typing things in, but it's especially helpful when you do have longer or more complicated bits of text or data to convey. So it's those interesting little squares you'll see every now and again. It's kind of like it's basically kind of like a barcode.
Sure.
With other information. If you really wanted, you could use it for checkout too. If it's just storing some text data usually.
So now to Catherine's question.
Yeah.
So now a series of them there.
So there are a variety of different sites out there that will create and also decode QR codes. So if you haven't seen it, I think it was maybe it was the 4th of July. I think there was there is a Rickroll using a QR code with drones. And so, you know, we see these square QR codes usually in print. Somebody actually used a collection of drones to actually make a big QR code in the sky. And people decided to take out their phones to take a picture of it and see what it was. Well, it ended up being a Rickroll. So they got redirected to a YouTube site that started this song that everyone's kind of used to seeing when they're kind of trying to misdirect you to something they don't want. So one of the safety concerns with QR codes is actually you never quite know what you're going to get when you scan one. So even if you are trying to use it legitimately, some end users might have that concern of, if I go there, I don't actually know what I'm going to. And you really don't know what you're going to until you actually try. And so that's kind of a concern there. If you are using an app, I usually use online web forms for QR code generation. One, I do like to take a look at reviews. Reddit and a variety of other sites can be really useful to help determine what QR code software might be free. And so if you do get recommendations from third-party websites, you might see them from CNET. You might see conversations in a variety of other forums like Reddit. You may get some good information to at least pick a safer product. Another item that can also be useful is if I do use a decoding or an encoding software to create one of these picture codes, I might take that code or that picture and feed it into a different decoder software. So basically having a third party basically tell me, what does this QR code say? Is it saying what I think it's saying, or is it redirecting me to a different site? And so that can be really useful. So you're basically trying to take two products and have them compare results. Am I getting what I anticipate when I use this QR code? I find that useful for a lot of things, getting two different products to compare and give me the same result. I always find useful. The more and more you do it, you're going to start having trust with a particular product, and then you might do that less often. But you also have that capability in the back end. Sometimes these QR codes use something like a URL shortener. And so they'll take your website and they'll actually make it a little bit more user-friendly, but it also gives you the capability to change that URL at a later date without changing the QR code, which is great. Because if you're printing a million copies of something, and you have to change the QR code itself to change that link, well, that's impossible. You already printed all this stuff and you can't do it. So having that capability to change where that goes in the future can actually be really, really useful, especially if you're using a lot of print publications. If it's on a website, it may be, you know, less of an issue because you can easily update that. So that could be one of the reasons to use one of those dynamic links that allows you to update that that background, but that can also be used potentially by a bad QR provider to also redirect instead of to your content, maybe to somewhere else. I always, you know, this is kind of one of those things when I look at basically any product, I like to look at reviews. I like to know what people are using, what other people deem as safe, and collaborate with others who might be doing the same thing. Just because there are a lot of items out there that can be used for a variety of reasons. My Android phone has the built-in capability to read QR codes. And so some devices might also have that capability to automatically, without needing separate software, to generate them. But I like to look at reviews. I like to see what they're doing. The dynamic ones can be very, very useful because you can update it, but you know, there's a potential risk if you don't have trust with that company that some of that data could change. Usually it's going to be tied in with your account. So when you're setting up that account, also make sure you're using a strong password. If you have multi-factor authentication that you can turn on, turn that on. But I do highly recommend check reviews, check what other people are doing, and use a different QR reader service to verify it's going where you think it should go. It could also just be your phone or another device to do that. If you really don't trust it, though, don't use your device to scan it because you wouldn't want something bad to happen. go to a different trusted third party to make sure to keep your device safe.
There you go, Catherine. Thanks so much for calling. Let's take a call from Dawn in Wauwatosa. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We've probably all heard the political ads that Tim Michaels has funded an organization called Veritas, which is tracking women who are going to Planned Parenthood clinics and then messaging them with anti-abortion literature. So my question is there technology that can scramble what Veritas is doing?
Hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, that's in, it's a little bit challenging with that too. So any kind of privacy online, anything that can be used to track, can be used to give somebody information you probably don't want to give them. There's a variety of guides on how to kind of keep yourself private online, and they can go really, really into the deep end of things where it really is meant to make sure no one in the world can find you based on your online activity. For anything where, you know, somebody might be concerned with tracking, I would recommend using technologies that are otherwise not affiliated potentially with an individual. That could be, you know, more anonymized email addresses or phone numbers to make tracking much more difficult. Even then, it's always good to keep in mind how you're using them. If you're at home on your normal internet connection, using an anonymized email address, depending on how that information is tracked, they might still have information about, well, you use this internet connection and I see a few people affiliated with it. So there might still be an issue with getting that information. So it's really challenging to be completely anonymous online. And I could recommend a variety of things to help do that. So information can't be easily gathered and used to understand activities and behaviors of people. But it does require a lot of work. It requires probably using virtual private networks, involves using dedicated devices that you don't have logged in with a variety of other services, which might be, for example, Google or Apple. Their devices generally you log into, you know, it's kind of has your user information in, so it could be a way to track you. Those are the only real ways to help minimize that risk, because, you know, there's just so many unknowns and so many things you can't control with that data without taking those steps, either due to a lack of legislation or a lack of other ways to make, you know, your activity anonymous. Even if you put your own home network under a VPN, the more you stay on that VPN, the more you can track the users on just a different internet connection. It's just a different data point to track. So trying to remain completely anonymous and to limit that data sharing is really, really tricky. If somebody already has the data and it's out there, there's not much you can do about it. It's out there. People have it. And likely, if there's one copy, there's many copies. So it's usually people have their own copy of similar data that they're using for a variety of needs. You might be able to control what data gets out there in the future. Even that is very difficult. But it's if it's already out there, it's very difficult to control. And it's likely going to be out there in perpetuity.
Hmm. And there's no way, I think Don was also saying, could I scramble the tracker? Or is there some way to scramble the tracker? And that's probably not a possibility. I mean, you were talking about it from her end or somebody else's end, the individual. But the tracker itself, you're not going to be able to have any impact on it.
It's going to be challenging. So, yeah. Being able to control anything with that kind of tracker is going to be difficult. The best thing you can do is, use technology that if they track it, it doesn't matter. So usually they're going to find a way to track something, but just make them track something, that doesn't tie back to you or to anyone else.
Now, yeah. There you go, Don. Thanks for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Kathy in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. He mentioned earlier about VPNs, and that's what my question's about. Does a VPN help protect you from your internet thumbprint or fingerprint and or cookies? Like, does it help in it? Like, how does a VPN help you?
Good question. So the primary benefit I see from a VPN or a virtual private network, which is really software you can have running on your computer that creates a tunnel or a dedicated secured network connection with you and whatever VPN provider that you have. And so it kind of maintains privacy within that tunnel where your internet service provider hopefully cannot read that information. So they can't collect information about the websites you might be browsing or other information about what's going on. Likely, if you're on your home internet connection, they're already going to have some of those that device information anyway. As soon as you're disconnected from a VPN, that data collection is there. And so there's not much you can do. It only takes a second. They have it. But a VPN can also help with a variety of other privacy features. And sometimes these are features you have to pay for, but they have additional privacy options that will try to limit advertisements or other trackers that could kind of indicate, you know, it's who you are and you're sharing this data. The downside with that is there's so many trackers, it's hard to get them all. And that's a challenge with any kind of privacy tool you might use. It only takes one of those trackers to get your data and then share it with everyone else. That kind of creates that challenge. So it can definitely help from privacy if you're traveling and you're concerned with the hotel's network, if you're not quite sure if the wireless is protected. A VPN can be great to make sure you have a better secured connection and less risk from somebody collecting data about you. And it can help with some of the other aspects. But there are some things I'd also recommend with a VPN. Also use browsers with certain privacy features turned on or different plugins. In addition to that, the device you're using can also be kind of a risk. If I'm using, for example, a device that's logged in and affiliated with a service, so Apple and Google, you know, for example, are two big ones. If I have an Android, I'm logged in with my Gmail account. If I have an iOS device, I'm logged in with my iCloud or Apple account. That's another way to track me that regardless of whether I'm using a VPN or not, somebody's got information about it. It's trackable to me in some way. And, you know, my browser information might be out there as well. So you can still limit cookies. You can use a VPN, but some of that information is still out there. And so there's basically layers of things that you can do, and they all help to improve your privacy online. But even if you do all of them, it can be really challenging. Once again, I think those are in the case where maybe you are, you know, in witness protection. That's a very special case where you might go to those extremes. For a standard end user, you can, you know, do what you can do, but there are likely still some services out there that are going to get a little bit of data from you, but at least you're going to be able to limit it somewhat. So I do recommend VPNs, especially for internet connections you're using when traveling, that you're not quite sure if it's secure or not. So VPNs can be useful for that, and they can remove some of those ads. You might just need to pay premium, but I also recommend, since most people are using web browsers, that's usually what, you know, people are using for most of their devices to access the internet. If they do have privacy features in there as well, either extensions or built into the browser that can be turned on, turn those on as well. Limit the cookies that you're storing. Cookies are going away a little bit, but even then, there's just so many things out there that are changing that can make it tricky. But those are a few things that I recommend. So VPN is still great, but it's got some limitations.
Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today and software with our guest, Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Trudy in Madison next. Hi, Trudy.
Hi, it's actually Judy, but I just wanted to make a comment about the Veritas call. Stalking is a felony in Wisconsin, and if someone is contacted by them at least two times and it causes emotional distress, the person should call their local police department and report it.
Yeah. I don't think you'll find any argument there, Jesse.
No, that's always a good thing to call law enforcement when you do have those concerns.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Judy, for calling. Appreciate it. Annie emailed us. She got a free phone from TrackPhone and is nervous about putting her information into it. Any suggestions or comments?
That's actually an interesting question. There's a lot of services we sign up for, and I think I always have the question is, do I really want to give them my information? What are they going to do with it? And I give people information when I know they need that information to help deliver the service. I haven't looked at any information for TrackPhone specifically. One thing I always recommend taking a look at, even though it can be the most boring thing to do, take a look at their terms of service or privacy policy, usually on their website. They might have it elsewhere on the phone. And just search for terms like data privacy or data or sharing. And usually it will help give you a better idea of what they might do with your information. So if you're putting in, for example, your email address, it might tell, do they sell that to other parties? Do they only use it to maintain the service? And then depending on what data you're giving them, usually it's relatively basic. If you're concerned with your email address, for example, I do like the idea of creating a separate email address that's only used for signing up for services that maybe I don't trust. And so you can give them a different email address, which isn't the primary email address you use for your, you know, day-to-day life business, that people can't get additional information from. So if they need the data to deliver the service, I think it might be needed to give the information they're asking for, but I think there's other ways to use different email addresses to share it. In some cases, people might give fake information because they don't want to give real information that might track them. That in itself, once again, is in the terms of service that might say, in order to use this, you need to give us accurate information. And so that's another reason that I do take a look at it. Otherwise, you could do something else. If you're concerned with the phone itself, like the phone itself may not be secure, there are kind of limited things you can do about it without having somebody take a look at the device to make sure that it's secure. Sometimes doing a factory reset on the device will make sure that it's at its defaults so that you can make sure you get the latest upgrades from whatever vendor that the software that the phone provider, the phone manufacturer came from. So usually a factory reset of device is usually pretty straightforward. You can get the device set up pretty quickly after that. And usually it doesn't require any contact with the provider. It should just reconnect and you're set there. But it also may still have a lot of the same software that you might be concerned with from a privacy perspective. So when you get your phone, if it's a smartphone, disable or uninstall applications that you either don't know anything about or that you don't use, which will hopefully protect you from sharing information that you don't want out there.
Let's go to Tom in Minnesota next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was wondering if anybody has brought up using the web browser called DuckDuckGo. It basically allows you to do browsing anonymously without trackers or anything like that. And you know, when I use a lot primarily for shopping, it prevents all those pop-ups coming up on my Facebook feed and things like that. But it's not my primary browser. I'll use Chrome or Firefox primarily. But if I want to do some shopping, I'll open up the DuckDuckGo browser.
Yep, DuckDuckGo is a really popular browser people like for privacy. There are some options to actually add some DuckDuckGo features to other browsers, some other extensions. So I do definitely recommend people take a look at some of those different options to hide that information. There is some information you may be just limited in being able to hide. For example, your IP address is usually going to be there somewhere. It has to be able to connect to the website. But having some of these privacy-focused browsers can be helpful to at least limit some of those trackers that a lot of people are concerned with. And DuckDuckGo is a very popular option people like.
Todd from La Crosse emailed, how do you recommend storing passwords for all the different sites and remembering to change them regularly?
Yeah, I recommend having a password manager. And there are a variety of ways to go about it. But if you look up password manager, you'll see all the different options. In my case, I do use a cloud-based product, which allows me to synchronize my passwords and use it with multiple devices. Because I might be using my mobile phone that I might be somewhere else, where I might need to access a password to log into an app or into a website. So I do recommend that. It can also help to create stronger passwords, which instead of just the one I can remember, all the passwords I create these days are ones I definitely will never remember, and they're far longer than any password I'd ever normally create. So the 20 plus character range. And so with Password Manager, you really need to remember that central password to get into your vault. And I also recommend if you do use Password Manager, turn on multi-factor authentication. To make sure, or at least to lessen the risk of somebody else breaking into it and getting that information. And that's the same with all these other sites. So if you're using, let's say, 100 websites, you might have them all in your password manager. Make sure all those passwords are unique, that they're all strong passwords. And even for those services, if you're able to have multi-factor authentication, I definitely recommend it. And most of those password managers will also have reminders that you can set up. Say, hey, by the way, it's been this long, you might want to consider changing your password. If you do have very long and strong and unique passwords and you have multi-factor authentication, I feel it's less important to change it more frequently because you already have a lot of features that are going to make it nearly impossible without somebody tricking you into giving them that information. So I do recommend using those best practices, and hopefully you don't have to change it every 3 months, every year, which has been the recommendation. You may never need to change it. Right now, I think if you have a 14 character password, it's going to take multiple centuries with existing computing power to break it. And if you're using 20, 25 character passwords that are randomized and that are saved in your password manager, that's going to be really useful. Adding multi-factor to that even makes it better and more challenging to break into. So I wouldn't be as focused on regularly changing them, just making sure use the strongest password possible, use multi-factor, use a password manager to organize all of that, and make sure your password manager is secured using multi-factor authentication. If you do those, you're going to be extremely safe, and your password manager can still give you reminders to change frequently, or let you know if you're using the same password on multiple areas, or if that password might have been noted in a breach somewhere. And so those are a few of the services some of those password managers can give you. But that's going to save you a lot of headaches, and you can make really strong passwords and never have to remember any of them.
Okay. That sounds good to me. And in maybe 30 seconds or so, Pat from Elm Grove sent us an email. They have an iPhone SE. Will they continue to receive support from Apple, even though the company has made newer phones?
Yeah, it's a good question. It will be supported up until a point, and then they will stop supporting it. I don't know what that support date is, but I think they have been releasing those for a little bit of time. But it will stop at some point. I just don't know what that date is.
But it's coming. Yeah. And they usually give pretty good notice on it as well. Jesse LeGrue is our guest today, and he is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. Jesse is an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group, and you can join in right now, get in line if you want to. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jesse. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at technology today on the show with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrue. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Jesse, an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He assists in designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. So questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Kathleen in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling.
Yes. So I was hacked on Facebook 2020. When I tried to get a new password, the password security code was sent to the hacker's email because they took over my email, inserted theirs. I can no longer get on my Facebook page. But the main problem I have is they got into a lot of stuff, and one was my Delta frequent flyer account, which has now been suspended. Delta said that I have to upload a photo ID on their website somewhere to be able to reinstate this Delta frequent flyer account. And I'm very nervous about uploading my driver's license or any personal information, given that I was hacked. So I haven't done anything, and I don't know if that's secure or not.
Yeah, it's a good question, and sorry if that happened to you. That's a challenging thing to go through. One thing I would recommend, at least with Delta, or if there is another organization, asking for more identity verification documentation. I'd always recommend reaching out directly to them from a public number or other contact mechanism on their website. So you can contact them from a known trusted number and really ask the question, hey, what information do you need to resolve this issue and where should that be sent? Really just trying to make sure that if you do have to send that kind of documentation, that you're sending it to a legitimate place. Sometimes that actually might be common for a variety of other services to validate an account where you're sending a little bit more personal or private information that otherwise you wouldn't be sharing, such as a driver's license number or something else. So I definitely recommend contact them with their public contact information, validate the information. Also see if there might be another way to validate that information, maybe through a third party, where maybe you could use a notary or something else to validate in person so that you don't need to digitally transmit that information. And that's a notary, at least to me, seems like a valid way where you're going to a place, giving information for them to validate, and that can help to validate from a third party. So I'd also ask, do I have any other options to make sure I can validate I am who I say I am and limit the sharing of that data? Because We all know it. When you put it on the internet, it's, you know, things can happen. And so do recommend doing that. And hopefully you can contact Facebook and they can help to get that resolved. Whenever an account is compromised, that is a common thing that these bad actors will do. They will try to redirect recovery questions or other communication mechanisms to something that they control. That might be a phone number, that might be an email address. So if you have had other accounts compromised, do check those items because they might have changed security questions or recovery email addresses or recovery phone numbers. And then make sure those are all cleared out. Usually Facebook and other companies will do that as a part of their normal process. But it's always good to take another look just to make sure no one else can get that recovery information.
Good luck, Kathleen. Thank you for calling. Virgil in Beaver Dam, your turn. Hi, Virgil.
Hi. I wonder if you, Jesse, if you can remember, can recommend the best password manager.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of password managers out there. I personally do prefer the ones that are cloud-based, just because you do get some other benefits, primarily when you're using multiple devices. Most of us aren't using simply a desktop or a laptop that's always in one physical location. We also have a mobile device that we might also be using to use our passwords with. Honestly, if that wasn't the case, I'd probably have a different recommendation because that password sharing back and forth may be less of a need. One of the things I also use my password manager for, I might have a need to share a credential or information with my spouse. So if they need that information or if something happens to me, they might be able to have access to those pieces of data. So, you know, unforeseen things happen. And if you do need to have somebody else take over accounts in those cases, a password manager can also help with that. There's a variety of password managers out there. 1Password has been, you know, a recommendation that a lot of people have liked. LastPass is another option. Keeper is another option that are out there. Personally, I've used LastPass in the past, and it's been a really good option for me, but there's a variety of other options out there. One thing to also keep in mind, if you are using a VPN or not, some of these packages can actually get bundled. So if you actually want a VPN and you also want a password manager and you might want some other kind of privacy or security mechanism, you might be able to also get it from the same place. So do take a look at some of those options that they have available, because you might want to simply stick with one organization for all of those things instead of choosing multiple different options. So those are some recommendations. Otherwise, you know, if you are using Google or Apple services, they also have password manager features now, I believe, in iCloud and some of the Google services, which can also synchronize through a variety of different devices. So those are some good options. Yeah. I don't think there's one. Something might fit for you. Do a trial and see if it works. If it doesn't, try a different one until you're ready to invest. Because usually some of them are going to have they might be free for limited features, or you might pay a monthly or an annual fee for a little bit more. But if you do want that VPN and some other things, take another peek just to make sure you might be able to save some money down the road too.
Virgil, thanks for calling. Lisa in Amberg called but couldn't stay with us. Her husband wants to sell his computer. How can she wipe it to make sure there's no information left on it?
That's another good question. There are some tools you can use to wipe data from a hard drive so that no one can get access to it. One thing I'd honestly recommend, I'd almost recommend keeping the hard drive and selling the computer without it. So let somebody purchase a new hard drive to put in that system. They can install whatever operating system they need to install on it. It kind of makes it a little bit easier for you and for them. Otherwise, there are some some data wiping applications you can use out there. They're a little bit trickier to use for kind of a standard end user, but you could use those as well. Even when you delete a file, it's technically still there, even though you can't see it. And that's kind of the risk you have when giving a hard drive to somebody else. They might be able to recover something from that hard drive. So I would actually just take the hard drive out, keep it. You could also find different computer repair centers. They might be willing to wipe it for a really low cost that could be repurposed to somebody else. Generally, I would just give it without a hard drive. They can worry about getting a new hard drive that they might want, and it saves you the hassle.
Yeah, makes sense. Keith emailed us. He made the mistake of clicking on links to purported PDFs within emails from friends and neighbors. He did it twice. On one of those occasions, it captured email addresses from Hotmail and proceeded to send out emails to all those addresses. He ran both Norton and Malware Bytes, and neither one found a virus. Is he okay? Keith doesn't keep passwords on his computer. He does allow Chrome to retain credit card information, but has to enter a CVS code for it to enter on commerce sites. He has monitored his credit card and reports no unusual activity.
Yeah, that's also another unfortunate situation too. So sorry about that. That can be tricky, especially when you don't know if your device is compromised still or not. One thing I would recommend, it's possible you might still have something on your computer. A lot of malware can still be, can trick other products into letting it go unseen by actually creating exceptions in those applications or by trying to evade them altogether. I might recommend actually, you could go to a computer repair center to have them take a look at it. What they'd probably recommend is actually to be completely safe, if you're not quite sure if there's still malware on your computer or if it's running in the background, you could do a backup of data that's important to you and then wipe and reinstall or do a factory restore. That can also be tricky, but if you're not quite sure, I probably would recommend that. Also, generally, browser storage of passwords or credit card data, depending on how it stores it, could be challenging, and there might be easy ways to get that to that information. I think you're doing the right thing. You're taking a look at your statements to see if there's any unusual activity, hopefully without the CVV code, which is usually that 3 or 4 digit code you need with your credit card information. Hopefully without that, no one's able to perform any online purchases. So do keep taking a look at that. If you ever do get worried, you can always proactively get new cards for those accounts. And usually those are going to be free of charge for most banks. But I would consider checking all your other accounts as well. If you do have a password manager, that makes it really easy to reset all the passwords for all those accounts. Just to make sure that you don't have any password out there that might have been compromised. And take a look at those accounts just to make sure there's no unusual activity. But it's possible you might still have something on your computer. You did run it through a couple different programs. If you do happen to know what kind of virus or what might have happened with that PDF, you might be able to do a little bit of research online to better understand what it's doing to your computer. And that could also tell you how to clean it up. With having that little piece of information might give you a better direction on what to do. If you're digging into the weeds and you decide it's just too technical or you're not quite sure what to do, once again, I think going to a third party to either get a cleanup or a rebuild of your computer would be another recommendation. So it is possible they got more. And I would say, you know, do what you're doing, check your accounts, look for other unusual activity. And if you can proactively reset those accounts just to make sure that no one has access to that data, even better. And if you're still concerned something might be on your computer, don't reset those accounts using that same computer. Because if there is something listening or trying to track what you're doing on that device, they might not have the data for your existing password, they might get it once you try to change it. So it's a little bit tricky. If you do have another computer that you trust, you know, use that to reset that information. But you know, I'd probably recommend it's always good to be to safe rather than sorry. So if you're not quite sure, have somebody take a look at it for you and give you a better idea.
Mona in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Mona.
Hi, thank you. I have a question. I'd like to know how to wipe my personal information off my Alexa. I don't use it, and I know I had to put a lot of personal information on it to set it up.
Yeah, it's a good question. So you can remove data. There is a, within settings, there's actually a privacy option. Within the privacy option, you can remove any data and it will delete any recordings or delete anything else stored on the device. If you are extra paranoid, I honestly wouldn't give it to anyone just because sometimes you use wiping features and they maybe not, don't wipe it to the extent that you would really want them to. But I'm guessing that there's probably not a lot of people taking apart Alexas these days to try to do that. Go to the privacy settings. You should be able to remove the data from there and reset the device. And then that should hopefully remove the capability or lessen the risk for somebody else getting that information. So you should find it right in privacy and settings.
Dale in Nina, it's your turn. Hi, Dale.
When I receive an anonymous message in the Apple Messages app on my home computer, what's the best response?
Good question. I'd say if you don't know the user, if it doesn't seem quite right, in my mind, the best response is no response. I would honestly ignore the message. I might remove it. If you can block it, or if you can report it, those would also be good options. If you are using iMessages, which allows you to use the messaging app from a mobile device with a phone number and with anything you might be logged in with your iCloud account, they might be using your phone number or they might be using your iCloud address. If they're using your phone number, you can also report it to your cell phone provider, and they might be able to block that phone number as well. So I've heard a couple individuals that have had a variety of spam and text messages come in that have been just really problematic, like 10 or 20 a day, actually just reporting it to their provider completely dropped that number. So if you do think they're coming in through the phone number and you do have a phone number that came in with the message, go ahead and report that as well so that you can get that blocked. But I do not recommend if it doesn't look quite right, if you don't know the individual, if they give you links and other things you're not quite sure about, don't click on the links, don't reply, report it, delete it, block it, and then, you know, worry about the next thing.
Mary emailed us with a question. She has, if she has a password manager and wants to leave information to her relative who has her power of attorney to access her accounts, what do they need to know to get through the password manager barriers? Just the primary password?
Yeah, that'll probably depend on the password manager that you're using. Some of them allow you to have multiple accounts and share data. And you can also kind of set that up with kind of the power of attorney or case of death in mind. So if you do have the unforeseen happen, you can have that capability of getting into the account. There are a couple of different ways to do it. One is the power of attorney will have access when something happens, or if the power of attorney always has access to those accounts. And so you can kind of go both ways. The more paranoid version is the power of attorney will only have access when something happens and they need to get access to that account. And it will be different depending on the password manager that you're using. But if you do simply just want to share passwords so you always have access when and if you need it, look for any password manager that allows shared accounts. And a lot of them will have family plans that will allow you to add multiple individuals. One, to save on the cost so everyone can have their own password manager, but also share specific details if you need to, either for kind of that power of attorney need or for just simple sharing need, because they don't allow you to create more than one password.
And Philip in Trempealeau has just relates exactly to this, I believe. Philip, hi.
It does, to what was just said. I've been using Dashlane Password Manager for quite a few years now, and I can't convince the rest of the family to get on board. And last year, one of the emails was compromised, and the people used it to access Walmart online, and it caused all kinds of problems, as you could imagine. So I'm just putting out there that it's really important that everybody in your house, you know, gets on board with it. And I got to pay this annual subscription so that you can have, you know, everybody in the home utilize the Dashlane. But I just haven't been able to convince them to do so. So I'm protected.
There you go, Philip. Comment on that one, Jesse?
Yeah, the adoption by others can be tricky, especially if they don't feel they have the need. I mean, we have a shared account, and we use it for, you know, our own stuff. But if we also need to share an account, one of the things I have in the password manager is our Wi-Fi password. If you want the Wi-Fi password, guess what you're going to need to do? You're going to need to activate your account so I can share it with you. And then you get access to the network. And then if I ever change the wireless password, you know exactly where to get it. I don't even need to tell you. You can just open your password manager and get to it. So that could be a way to incentivize people being able to be on board. I think that password sharing, if you do have those aspects that you really do need to share it because there is a requirement for a shared account or a need to share something that's just simply sensitive and it's difficult to otherwise transmit back and forth, those can be good reasons to kind of move in that direction, because it really does help everyone when you're in that same environment. Maybe they don't feel the need for their own data, but as soon as you get into it, honestly, you start wondering why you were never doing this before.
So, Philip, that Wi-Fi, that's a good suggestion or a good tip to get everybody on board. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And, Jesse, here we are out of time. Thank you so much. Boy, learned a lot today, and I know our listeners did, and look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Oh, man. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He'll be back, and we'll talk with him again for sure. Coming up tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we talk about how life can survive without water. And we'll also cover a legislative effort to help thousands of at-risk animal species. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. But you know what? There's lots more in store here right through the afternoon on the Ideas Network, and I hope you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.